I'm going to try and give a brief update on some of the things that I think are a little bit interesting and novel in the field of the diagnosis, treatment, and philosophy of anaphylaxis. But why would you care about that? So I'll start with that, then we'll talk about the definition of anaphylaxis, some of its cardinal manifestations, the differential diagnosis, some of the triggers, the mechanisms, which is where a lot of the bedside research is, of course, and then some of the key things about treatment and prevention. So why would you care about anaphylaxis, right? Well, one thing is it seems really rare, but in fact its incidence is very underreported. And we know that not so much by knowing the true incidence, but by small studies that have been done in the last 5 to 10 years documenting that when information is only partial on emergency room visits, follow-up indicates that a majority of people who were considered to have an adverse drug reaction of some unknown type oftentimes qualify for the diagnosis of anaphylaxis. More concerning, perhaps, is that we are some of the prime causes of anaphylaxis, and by we, I mean practitioners of Western medicine. Anaphylaxis is, of course, potentially fatal, which raises the stakes. And asthma, which is the raison d'etre of the asthma center, is a critical component of it. Perhaps not a sine qua non, but something that certainly contributes both to the clinical picture and to the potential fatality of anaphylaxis. And last but not least, early intervention is often life-saving, while delay in treatment dramatically increases the risk of fatality. So, many have become familiar by reading one or the other textbooks or review articles with the idea that we shall debunk in a few minutes, that anaphylaxis is an ancient disease that a pharaoh Menes from 2600 BCE died of anaphylaxis. But in fact, anaphylaxis is a relatively new player on the block. There were sporadic reports in the older medical literature in the 16th through 19th centuries. And really, it was given its name by Portier and Richer in 1902, when they were playing around in the lab with some dogs. And it's not so much that they created anaphylaxis, but they did recognize it, and they did name it. And they did so under the following circumstance. They were using the venoms of some different sea anemones, and they were attempting to induce a protective immunity in some dogs by injecting them with sublethal doses of the sea anemone venom. In so doing, they inadvertently sensitized some of those dogs, and on re-exposure to the sea anemone venom, these dogs had massive hypersensitivity reactions and died. Now, one of the critical things that's gone on in the last 2 to 3 years has been the struggle to come up with a firm consensus definition of anaphylaxis. That may seem a bit too philosophical or a bit too ivory tower, but I think it has critical implications, not the least reason of which is that having a strong diagnosis of anaphylaxis, defining anaphylaxis clearly, is, in my mind, critical to recognizing it. And recognition with celerity is critical to survival and the appropriate treatment of anaphylaxis. If we're standing waiting for the shuttle, and I say, I wonder what the neurochemical basis of infatuation is. I wonder how people become infatuated. That's a clear question, right? You can understand what I'm saying. But if I'm standing next to you while we're waiting for the shuttle, and I say, tell me, where is fancy bread? Or in the heart? Or in the head? How begot? How nourished? That poetic explosion, apart from being a justifiable reason for you to walk away from me, is the exact same question. Yet you know that when I spoke the second part, you were in the presence of poetry. And the same thing is true in a kind of squishy way, for better or for worse, with anaphylaxis. It's one of those things where when you're in the presence of it, you know it after you've seen it. If someone, say, at your dinner party suddenly breaks out in urticaria, starts wheezing, has chest pain, and you think, oh my gosh, something really bad is happening here. As Ed Hunter once told me, the hardest part of an ethical dilemma is knowing when you are in one, and largely the same thing can be said truly of anaphylaxis. The critical thing is to recognize it, and recognizing it means defining it clearly. So about 3 to 4 years ago, Phil Lieberman proposed the following definition, that anaphylaxis is a systemic immediate hypersensitivity reaction caused by immunoglobulin E mediated immunologic release of mediators from mast cells and basophils. That was a fairly easy definition, but the question of whether it bears scrutiny is still undetermined. This issue about the definition of anaphylaxis engendered not one but two different symposia on the definition of anaphylaxis hosted by the NIAID, and reports with Hugh Sampson as the lead author were issued for both of them, one in 2005 and the second one in 2006. The bottom line there is that they defined anaphylaxis as a severe, potentially fatal systemic allergic reaction that occurs suddenly after contact with an allergy-causing substance. Notice here that they have intentionally omitted any mechanism mentioned. They did not say IgE, they did not say mast cell, they did not say basophil, and there's a reason for that. I'd like to focus for just a second on what anaphylaxis does, though, and its definition as seen in a functional manner. This patient shows up in the allergy clinic, and she says, "I had a terrible reaction, I almost died." And you think, well, we got to get her an allergist, someone to evaluate her. So you choose an allergist, and you bring in someone who's a seasoned practitioner. And he looks at the patient, talks to the patient, most importantly, and he determines that there's the possibility that this reaction was anaphylaxis. He therefore turns to one of his colleagues, who is an important anaphylaxis researcher. My slides are malfunctioning. But with that, my slides are really malfunctioning. Okay, well, you have to forgive me then. Dr. Sheffer here, disappears. He goes off to play golf because he gets something called the sense of doom. And I had a great little, video here to illustrate that, but it's not going to cooperate with me. Dr. Castells stays with the patient, and she may test the patient, she may even challenge the patient. And in so doing, she's going to transform this woman into this woman. This is the same patient. This is when she's got significant facial angioedema, and you can see that she's wearing a Johnny because she's in the emergency department because she was significantly hypotensive. Dr. Castells also, however, will provide the treatment that will revert this patient back to this highly functioning, non-angioedematous woman. So this dramaturgical dyad tells you a bunch of important information if you are open to it. The first is that the patient is telling you the story, and the patient's story is absolutely critical. The history is the most important tool to establish the cause of anaphylaxis and takes precedence over diagnostic tests. You define anaphylaxis, you identify it, you treat it based on the clinical diagnosis of what happened to the patient. Dr. Sheffer's sense of impending doom is a critical piece, not only for the feelings of the patient, but for the feelings of you, the practitioner. If when you see this, you think something is terribly wrong, you're probably right. Dr. Castells raises the issue of Western medicine, both its contribution to anaphylaxis in terms of causing it, measuring it, and rescuing people from it. Let's see if this will work. Okay, what about anaphylactoid? You may have read this word before. This is a bad word. I know that from my fellowship. Anaphylactoid reactions, that was the name originally given to reactions that were clinically indistinguishable from anaphylaxis, but that had a different mechanism, either non-IgE-mediated mast cell-mediated release, or some other mechanism that we weren't sure about. We were, for a time, led to consider the possibility that there might be IgG-mediated reactions, as are seen in murine systems. But suffice it to say that these are clinically identical reactions. They don't have the same molecular mechanism, but we're not sure whether it makes a difference in terms of the treatment, the prognosis, anything about that. Okay? So there's at least two mechanisms that we know of. One is IgE-mediated mast cell activation, and one seems to be IgE-independent mast cell release. As I said before, this is a pretty modern disease, and there are many 2,600 years before the Common Era was said to have died of a wasp or hornet sting. In fact, that has been debunked, and there's no evidence that he died from that because the hieroglyph for the stinger was just a scratch on his sarcophagus, and that's been kind of dispensed with. as I said, it was really only about 400 years ago that spurious single reports started cropping up, and within the last century or century and a half that we've seen a steady stream of these reports. So what are the clinical manifestations? The second symposium, headed by Hugh Sampson, determined the following, that any one of these following three criteria will suffice for a diagnosis of anaphylaxis. It's the acute onset of an illness in minutes to several hours with involvement of the skin, which is almost a sine qua non if you look carefully, mucosa or both, and that can be Heim's angioedema, both, or just erythema and pruritus. And then at least one of the following, respiratory compromise, such as an asthma flare, stridor, reduced peak flow, even hypoxemia, and or some cardiovascular finding, like reduced blood pressure, or associated symptoms such as suggesting end organ perfusion problems, such as presyncope or syncope. However, if you can't get that, but you find that there's the rapid occurrence after exposure to a likely allergen for that patient within minutes to several hours, and there is skin or mucosal involvement, respiratory compromise, reduced blood pressure, or signs and symptoms of that, and persistent GI symptoms, then that gets you the diagnosis. And last but not least, reduced blood pressure after exposure to a known allergen for that patient, again, the history is critical. And note that in infants and children, low systolic blood pressure has to be considered within the context of their age. But in fact, as Josh Boyce is shaking his head, he's absolutely right, because low blood pressure is not the cardinal symptom that you're looking for in children. In children, what is deadly is respiratory compromise. And almost always, cardiac disease in children, cardiac findings, are secondary to respiratory collapse in children. Is that right or wrong?
Tachycardia.
Thank you very much. In adults, you can depend a little more on the hypotension. When you look at a number of studies, about a dozen of them in different emergency departments around the globe have documented the frequency of different organ involvement in documented anaphylaxis. You'll find reports of cutaneous involvement around 90%. Some reports will say, well, it's 80%, and really you have to be careful because 20% of people will not have any rash, erythema, pruritus, Heim's, angioedema, anything like that. That is a bit of a soft number. It depends how hard you look. In a number of reports, they had almost 100% findings when someone was evaluated thoroughly, a full dermatologic exam, before the administration of epinephrine. So most people have at least some skin flushing and oftentimes some pruritus. Respiratory complaints follow second, but really only 40 to 60% of patients will have that. But a significant proportion of them will really have an asthma flare. Dizziness, syncope, hypotension, suggestions of end organ perfusion problems follow, and then GI complaints. And that can be anything, that can be anything from upper GI complaints to cramping pain and diarrhea. And then there's a number of miscellaneous things. Sometimes you'll even see reports of people who have disseminated intravascular coagulation or some tremendous hematologic disaster in the presence of anaphylaxis. So what about getting some objective or semi-objective scale to grade the severity? Brown in 2004 did a retrospective analysis of over 1,100 patients in an Australian hospital ED who qualified for the diagnosis of anaphylaxis over the course of a number of decades. He then performed statistical analyses to look for symptoms that correlated between either hypotension or hypoxemia to try and grade the severity from mild, which is generally limited to cutaneous findings, to moderate to severe. And this busy slide is too small to really read, but what it demonstrates is that a number of symptoms, such as anxiety, are really not statistically significant for determining who's going to get hypotension or who's going to get hypoxemic. The opposite is true for other symptoms, such as weakness or feeling faint. So when he did the final analysis for the logistic regression analysis, the minimum set of predictors for documented hypotension included incontinence, collapse, including loss of consciousness, not hard to imagine, diaphoresis, cyanosis, vomiting, dizziness, dyspnea, and nausea. That list was a little bit different from the signs and symptoms that were going to be predictive of hypoxemia. That included confusion, stridor, dyspnea, hypotension, and wheezing. He came up with the following grading system. Mild reactions were generally limited to the skin and subcutaneous tissues only. And they included things like generalized erythema, as well as the more easily recognized urticaria and angioedema. Moderate included respiratory disease, cardiovascular signs and symptoms, or GI involvement, and could include any of these symptoms. And then severe was hypoxemia, hypotension, and or neurologic compromise. That having been said, he found a number of interesting things. The likelihood that you receive epinephrine for anaphylaxis increased with severity of the anaphylaxis. But even among the patients who were diagnosed with severe anaphylaxis, the rate of getting epinephrine was under 70%, which is very concerning, because that is the life-saving medication. Careful observation in his review indicated that really almost all patients had some skin findings. Univariate analysis, and this bears on what Elliot was saying earlier about his dinner guest, indicated that drugs like ACE inhibitors and beta blockers could track with the severity, suggesting that if a patient is on one of these drugs, at least univariate analysis suggested that that increased the risk of more severe anaphylaxis. But when they did the multinomial logistic regression, those variables fell out, and they were left with three really interesting variables. One was age. The older you are, the more likely anaphylaxis is to be severe. The second thing was whether or not insect venom, which carried the highest odds ratio, was involved. Insect venom is bad. Now, to take a little bit of a tangent, this is somewhat in support of Tom Platz-Mills' theory that we mount more aggressive hypersensitivity reactions against proteins derivative from species farther from us. We are more sensitive, Platz-Mills argues, to things like Hymenoptera venom, possibly because of its enzymatic activity, but maybe just because it is so foreign, and things like dust mite antigen than we are to mammal-derived antigens such as cat dander. That theory is obviously controversial, but it's suggestive, at least in this case, because the odds ratio was almost 2 3/4 increased for a severe anaphylactic reaction. Lastly, importantly, iatrogenic causes. There seems to be a difference between the anaphylaxis and the likelihood of severe anaphylaxis in the guy who accidentally ingests a peanut than the guy who is given radiocontrast material that's of high osmolality or osmolarity, or the patient that's given penicillin accidentally, or even not accidentally, but without the realization that he or she is penicillin hypersensitive. Pre-existing lung disease, such as asthma, but also COPD, was associated with hypoxia, but not in the multivariable logistic regression with severity of an attack. So what's the differential diagnosis? Well, you have to consider flushing syndromes like carcinoid. There are postprandial or restaurant syndromes, such as Schromburg fish poisoning, which essentially is the ingestion of large amounts or volumes or concentrations of histamine, which can recapitulate a number of the symptoms of anaphylaxis. Systemic mastocytosis, I fear to speak that with Mariana Castells in the audience, but that's what they say. Pheochromocytoma obviously can oftentimes be distinguished clinically and then biochemically from anaphylaxis, but it's not so easily done on first presentation necessarily. Vasovagal reactions are very important because people can get some skin findings. People definitely can get hypotension. They can feel that impending sense of doom. They know that something is wrong. Panic attacks, undifferentiated somatoform idiopathic anaphylaxis, or USIA. USIA was an important component in the 1996 analysis of 355 patients with so-called idiopathic anaphylaxis, where extensive studies and historical investigation failed to reveal an obvious trigger. But there are people who fit the psychological profile of people who have symptoms that they subjectively report that sound like anaphylaxis, but there are no objective findings. hypoglycemia and shock, either septic, cardiogenic, or really any form of it, even neurogenic shock, can sometimes look like anaphylaxis. Let me talk briefly about some mechanisms, and how could I do that without mentioning mast cells? Arguably, mast cells are the critical cell in human systems for the phenomenon of anaphylaxis. Recent work over the last couple of years has focused on a question that Mariana Castells asked last summer, which is, what is the role of basophils in human anaphylaxis? And I put a question mark by that because the data are not strong for a number of reasons that I'll get to. The distinction between mediators and biomarkers is not a sharp one. Clearly, histamine, which can come from mast cells or basophils or both, is an important one, as we've seen with scrambled fish poisoning, because that can recapitulate a number of the symptoms, signs, and findings of anaphylaxis. But cystine leukotrienes are obviously critical as well. And mast cell tryptases are considered by some to have enzymatic activity or even cell signaling capabilities that could contribute to anaphylaxis, but many people consider that there are no strong data to support that contention and that really they're just a biomarker of mast cell activation. What are the mechanisms? Well, the most obvious one is the cross-linking of antigen-specific IgE on the surface of mast cells, or basophils, by an antigen such as the peanut antigen ArH1 or penicillin. Autoantibodies against the high-affinity IgE receptor or the IgE molecule itself have been found by Alan Kaplan and others to participate in somewhere between 35% and 50% of people with chronic idiopathic urticaria. And interestingly, a number of those patients can see a kind of crescendo pattern where what starts off in 2002 as increasingly severe and frequent idiopathic urticaria can eventually turn into an anaphylactic episode. Direct mast cell releasers such as opioids, radiocontrast material, and then finally the nervous system in one old but fascinating study that we'll review in a minute. There are really two competing, non-mutually exclusive hypotheses for how you could get widespread mast cell activation in the human body. The first one is the so-called broadcast hypothesis, which is that the presence of an antigen or other trigger in the body diffuses, essentially, and all the yellow mast cells here receive a high enough stimulus to activate. The second, and arguably more attractive, controversial model is the so-called network hypothesis, that antigen enters at an anatomically distinct location, say inhalation or injection or infiltration of the skin when I'm stung, and the mast cells in that immediate anatomic area are activated. They in turn release products and send signals that activate the mast cells nearest to them, and those mast cells activate the ones nearest to them until the entire network is activated. So the broadcast hypothesis is what mathematicians call inelegant, but possible. So if we do just a little bit of math, we can assess whether this is a viable hypothesis. Let's say that a subject is allergic to peanuts and has proven hypersensitivity, where he will anaphylax with the ingestion of peanuts. He's an average 70-kilogram guy. His total body water is about 60% of that, or 42 liters. Let him eat 1 gram of defatted, dry roasted peanut flour, which is about 50% protein by mass. This patient will be sensitive, we fiat, to ArH1, which is also called vinculin, and only that. That has a molecular weight of about 64 kilodalton, or 64,000 grams per mole. So what are the number of molecules that are going to distribute through his body water if ArH1 is 100%, 10%, or 1% of the protein content in what he ingests? So to do this, we have to fudge a little bit, and there are people in the audience who can correct this slide for us later at the end. But basophils, which admittedly are not mast cells, but they're at least a guide, carry anywhere from about 5,000 to a million high-affinity IgE receptors on their surface. You need to cross-link anywhere from 200 to 3,000 of them to activate a basophil. If you presume that each molecule of ArH1 has anywhere from 2 to 10 IgE binding sites, depending on the patient's panoply of IgE that recognize that protein, then you need somewhere from only 20 molecules per mast cell or basophil to anywhere up to 15,000 to get activation. Let's say that he eats this and that a certain amount of it, let's say that two-thirds of what he ingests is catabolized in the stomach. Well, the remaining one-third is going to distribute in the total body water, but really it's not going to get into the intracellular water. It's going to stay in the extracellular fluid. So those two cancel each other out, and division by three and multiplication by three leaves us with the same amount of molecules, the same number of molecules distributed in the extracellular total body water. Okay, so then the patient ingests half a gram, 50 milligrams or 5 milligrams of ERA-H1, and the equilibrium concentration here is going to be 11.9 micrograms per mil, or a tenth of that, or a hundred of that. And if you take a mast cell diameter of about 12.8 microns and you calculate the volume of an average mast cell, you'll see that given the molecular mass and Avogadro's number, depending on what percentage ERA-H1 is of that protein he ingests, you're going to get within a log range of the number of molecules per mast cell volume that you would need to activate that mast cell. So a small amount of protein flour, right, of peanut flour, could potentially be enough to just distribute through the body and activate those mast cells. And the nefarious part of it is that even if the network hypothesis is wrong, the mast cells that activate first are going to do what to the blood vessels they sit next to? They're going to release histamine and dilate those blood vessels. That's like the royal road to distributing that ERA-H1 throughout the body water. So it's, in a sense, if not a positive feedback loop, at least a feed-forward system to distribute that protein and alert the other mast cells by either an inelegant or an elegant mechanism to the presence of that antigen. So an interesting report came out last year reviewing the mast cell tryptases. I defer to Rich Stevens, who is one of the world experts on mast cell tryptases. But I just reproduce this to point out the important issue with respect to diagnostic testing. There are really four tryptases, at least. There's an alpha, a number of beta genes, a gamma, and a delta. Delta seems not to have so much enzymatic activity. Gamma has a transmembrane component to the molecule that keeps it tethered to the surface of a mast cell upon degranulation. So the critical ones are alpha and beta. Alpha and beta, in their pro form, are kind of constitutively released into the circulation. It used to be believed that, therefore, alpha tryptase is a measure of mast cell burden. In fact, that has been shown largely to be untrue, and that the majority of that alpha is either catabolized or swamped by the amount of pro-beta that's present. And that's so-called immature tryptase, or immature beta tryptase. That's in contradistinction to proteolytic cleavage of the propeptide that produces tetramers of beta tryptase that's stabilized by heparin. That's what's released with mast cell degranulation. That so-called mature tryptase is therefore the best marker of mast cell activation. So alpha tryptase is not reliable, according to that review, as a biomarker of mast cell degranulation or of the number of mast cells in the body. Beta tryptase seems to be the important one, and you should measure the total and then get the mature and immature from that if you can. The kinetics of tryptase are important. They're going to lag behind the histamine spike, which can occur within minutes to an hour. But the problem is that histamine is a pretty transient player in the blood and may be easy to miss. Tryptase in some cases, especially idiopathic anaphylaxis, can stay elevated for prolonged periods, even beyond 6 hours, even when the patient's already feeling better. While there are tantalizing hypothetical reasons to suspect that tryptases may contribute to the pathobiology of anaphylaxis, that is really an unresolved question at this time. Okay, what about basophils? My love-hate relationship with the cells that are much easier to obtain and study than mast cells, but not really a legitimate surrogate for mast cells. So there's a problem with basophils. They're ambiguous. They have certain characteristics that make them a delicious-looking target for our attention. Why? They have Fc epsilon R1. They bind IgE. They contain histamine. It's easy to obtain them, relatively speaking, and we can activate them to a number of antigens. The problem is that if you just sit back and think about it, you forget all benchside biology. when someone has a problem with too many mast cells, what do I call that? Well, that's mastocytosis. Do patients with mastocytosis get anaphylaxis? Yes, they do. They can be stung by bees on the first time, and they can get massive mast cell activation, and they can die. Okay, what about basophilia? What does that? Well, the easiest thing to study is chronic myelogenous leukemia. Do patients with CML get anaphylaxis? Well, at 2 in the morning today, I did a search for anaphylaxis and CML, and there are 6 papers that come up to it, and all 6 of them are talking about anaphylaxis in response to one of the medicines used to treat it. So there are no documented reports of anaphylaxis in a kind of native CML patient who, say, gets stung by a bee or eats a peanut, to suggest that basophil increases will predispose someone to anaphylaxis the way mast cell increases will. That's obviously circumstantial evidence. But there are a lot more people with CML than there are with mastocytosis. What about basophils, not so much in terms of their pathobiological role, but as a relatively easily obtained marker? Can we use something about basophils to diagnose or identify or further characterize anaphylaxis? So one of the groups down at Johns Hopkins studied 35 patients with confirmed Hymenoptera venom hypersensitivity. And a number of these, I think 12 of them, had large local reactions and were skin test positive. And 9 of them had systemic reactions, 5 of them receiving immunotherapy, 4 of them not. And then the remaining 14 did not have reproducible reactions, and so they chucked those patients out of the study. So they had 21 patients. They actually stung those patients in the clinic, and they analyzed the responses of their basophils before and after sting challenge, and then they later on took their basophils 3 months later and analyzed in vitro the responses of their basophils to exposure to Hymenoptera venom that was relevant for each patient. Again, this is a little bit too small, so I apologize. This group over here are the large local reactors. This group here are the ones that had systemic reactions and were on immunotherapy. And this group here had systemic reactions or large local reactions but were not on immunotherapy. And this first panel shows CD63, a marker of basophil activation. The second one shows CD69, second marker of basophil activation. And the third one shows CD203C, yet another marker of basophil degranulation. The green bars are prior to sting challenge, and the gray bars are post-sting challenge. So a few hours after sting challenge, you can see, especially among the patients in this group that had systemic reactions, even though they're on life-saving immunotherapy, they had dramatic increases on average in their CD63. CD203 showed a dramatic increase as well for these patients and not so much for the patients with large local reaction or for those who were not on immunotherapy. And this is just the statistics showing that there were significant increases in CD69 and CD203C, both in vivo and in vitro. This has yet to really be trotted out for prime time, but it's suggestive that basophils, regardless of our information about their role in the actual pathobiology, may be useful, but right now it's a little dicey. Right? You need to know what the expression level was before and how many people are going to get a baseline basophil CD69 expression profile. It's not an easy test yet. I promised you I would say something quickly about the nervous system, and I'll keep that promise. This is from a much referenced paper from 1989. I had a lot more hair back then. And the McQueen group showed something absolutely fascinating. And here I kind of slide away from humans into other mammals. This study was done in rats, using rat mucosal mast cell protease 2, a relatively specific marker for mast cell activation in the rat. They took a bunch of rats and they sensitized them to egg albumin, EA, right here. They then paired that so-called unconditioned stimulus that was going to cause anaphylaxis in the rats, or at least mast cell activation in the rats, with a conditioned stimulus. In this case, it was an audiovisual stimulus, some flashing lights and some nice party music. They then came back and did one of the following things. They either took the rats that had had the paired unconditioned and conditioned stimulus and boosted them, and then on day 60 gave them just PDS and the audiovisual stimulus, the conditioned stimulus, or they had a control group that had been treated the same way, but they had separated the audiovisual stimulus from the booster injections by one day, and then they gave them the same stimulus. The negative control never got a antigen, but they got the audiovisual stimulus. And then the positive control got the egg antigen and the audiovisual stimulus on the same day. And here are the results. The positive control had significant release of the mast cell protease. The rats that only saw on day 60 the audiovisual stimulus had an equal release of mast cell protease. Audiovisual stimuli, party music, can stimulate mast cells as effectively as re-exposure to antigen. That explains why I trouble your attention with the background of this slide. This drawing of neuron by Ramon y Cajal, which I'm terribly butchering his name, is sidled up to this mast cell because we know from Dan Friend and others that in tissues, mast cells live not only near blood vessels, but they oftentimes live near peripheral nerves. What's the likelihood that nerves can talk to mast cells and that mast cells can talk back to nerves? That is not trivial. That sense of doom that Dr. Sheffer gets, so that by the time Dr. Castells really gets a hold of that patient, he's on like the seventh hole, that's real. Mast cell activation may send neurologic signals to the central nervous system, and the central nervous system may send signals back to the peripheral mast cells. However, having slid into non-human mammals, I need to sign a cautionary note. You know, I know, we all know that mice and rats are not humans, and their immune systems are not humans. And a beautiful review by Mark Rothenberg and others that came out last year really kind of summarized the field, which I don't have time to go into in depth, but just to kind of pay it some lip service. There are important models of anaphylaxis in mice, and they're used right in our own division. But there are important differences between the mast cells of humans and the mast cells of non-human primates and non-human mammals, rather. So, for example, there's weak activation of murine mast cells by IgG, and there's no definitive evidence yet that that occurs in humans, and that's probably by Fc-gamma-R3 receptor. I've got to press on, so please excuse me, because I've got to get to some of the important things for today's discussion. What are the triggers? Well, I mentioned that Western medicine is, if it takes the credit for rescuing people from anaphylaxis, it also takes some of the culpability for triggering anaphylaxis. And in most studies, the two agents that vie with each other for the most common causes or triggers are drugs and foods. Foods you can't do much about, although it's interesting to note that the frequency of allergic reactions and anaphylaxis to peanut when peanut is boiled, as it is in China, is a fraction of what it is here in the United States and Western countries where we dry roast peanuts. So something about food processing may be important in antigen preservation or destruction. Penicillin, aspirin, NSAIDs, radiocontrast material, anesthetics. Did your dinner guest pop an aspirin before he came over? An Aleve. Okay, so there you have it, right? So he took an Aleve, and no, history. That's an important possibility that he is now hypersensitive to nonsteroidals. Foods, obviously in adults, the most common ones are fish, shellfish, tree nuts, peanuts, soy, milk, egg, wheat, the common players. Venoms, and down south, and hopefully it'll stay that way, but there's no evidence that you can stop evolution. Down south, fire ant hypersensitivity is critically important. If I am playing out in the grass and I get bitten even between the toes, a good emergency room physician in Florida will look between my toes when I anaphylax, looking for the sting of a fire ant. That happens in rarer cases here because of the so-called isotherm limitation. But give it a few years and ants will probably adapt. Exercise and other physical agents, this was really a revolution that occurred in the understanding of the triggers for anaphylaxis. And it was really championed by Dr. Scheffer and Dr. Austin. It was in the 1980s that this was really recognized as a potential trigger, and its association of, say, exercise alone or exercise with food really made us rethink, how is that happening? What's the antigen? What's the stimulation? Is it the nervous system? Is it protein processing that's different in an exercising human than in a non-exercising human? Not clear yet. Okay. So the late great luminary rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who lived in Brookline, was fond of making a distinction. You know, the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, has hundreds of different commandments. And it was believed by a number of religious philosophers that you could easily categorize these religious commandments into two big pots. They're the kind called mishpatim, laws, or judgments, as it's translated in the King James Version, which were generally those commandments that were amenable to rational analysis. You could understand them. Things like don't murder, don't steal, you know, the social contract. I could have figured that out on my own. Then there are the commandments that are called chukim, the ones that are kind of transrational, that we don't understand, but God said them, so okay, we'll do them. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a fantastic religious philosopher as well as a very revered rabbi. And he was the one who, early in the game, pointed out in the last century that that distinction is a complete fantasy. If you think you know the rational basis for this law or that law, it's really just a projection. We don't really understand anything. Why do I mention this? What is going on with Leviticus 18:23 that I bring it to your attention? Well, I mentioned before that history is the critical thing. And if somewhere around 15 or in some studies 25% of patients had idiopathic anaphylaxis, you can argue that that is because an insufficient history was taken. What were you doing before you had the reaction? Well, I was at home. Well, what were you doing? Did you eat anything? No. Did you take any Aleve? No. What were you doing? I was just at home. I was watching TV, right? Okay. What does it say? Leviticus 18:23. Neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself with it. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down before it. It is a perversion. Now, I'm not saying that the Bible says that because you can get anaphylaxis that way, but it has happened and it has been reported. This is the story of a 42-year-old woman who got anaphylaxis from her dog. And this is not some obscure reference. The most recent practice parameters list this, if you're interested, in reference number 159 of almost 300 references. So you have to dig and know what somebody really was doing. This may put you in an uncomfortable position. Certainly this woman was probably in an uncomfortable position, but that was her choice. Okay, how do you treat this? And then I've got to wrap up. You've got to do the ABCs, and that seems simple-minded, but you've got to do it. You've got to worry first about airway, because laryngeal angioedema can cut off someone's airway as well as make them asthmatic, and they can, as we know from the Brown study, become significantly hypoxemic, and they can die. Then you've got to do the blood pressure and the circulation. Epinephrine. This is the one thing to know out of this talk. Epinephrine is a highly charged issue. Everybody's worried about it because it raises blood pressure. What if this 78-year-old guy has an MI or a stroke? But epinephrine is the key drug for most patients with anaphylaxis. Delay in giving epinephrine is one of the greatest risk factors for death by anaphylaxis. And most of the severe adverse reactions to epinephrine occur because of overdosage, because of over-aggressive, because of stacking administration, or because of IV administration. And I'll go over administration of epinephrine in a minute. There's a lot of consensus on epinephrine. One, it is the primary drug to give when you are convinced that this is anaphylaxis. The route and the location of administration are agreed upon. It should be intramuscular in the anterior lateral thigh. But doctor, he's got angioedema in his throat. Shouldn't we stick him in the throat? No. The anterolateral thigh is where you should give the epinephrine. I'll show a bit of data on that in a second. There is some ignorance about epinephrine, though. We don't know the exact dose. We don't know the frequency of the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics in real patients, because most of these studies were scouted out in healthy young volunteers who were not experiencing anaphylaxis. And certainly, the circulatory pattern of someone who's experiencing anaphylaxis is not necessarily the same as someone who's a healthy, normal, comfortable volunteer. There was a report last summer about the use of rapidly dissolving sublingual tablets that could achieve, when they used somewhere around 120 times the dose, equal plasma concentrations of epinephrine. The only problem with that is that it was done in rabbits, which is good, but we haven't tested it in humans yet. Giving epinephrine by sublingual tablet would arguably improve time to and frequency of administration to epinephrine because people don't like stabbing themselves with a needle. And lastly, side effects. As I said, most of the side effects that you expect to see with the proper dose and frequency of epinephrine are tolerable and include pallor, tremor, heart pounding, headache, shivers, dizziness. This is an important piece of data from the 1990s showing the differences in routes of administration of the same dose of epinephrine. In yellow, if you give an epinephrine pen in the anterior lateral thigh, you will see this pattern of plasma epinephrine concentrations. You'll see an initial spike, then it will go down, possibly because of muscle vasoconstriction. And then you'll see a couple minutes later a second peak, and then arguably a third peak over here. What if you give it either subcutaneously or intramuscularly, but in the deltoid? You get nothing. You get no better than saline. So don't, please, don't give it in the arm. You give epinephrine in the anterolateral thigh. Then what else can you give? Well, you go by what the patient's got. Hypoxemic, give them oxygen. Give them inhaled beta two agonists if they have bronchospasm that's refractory to the epi. Intravenous fluids for hypotension. Vasopressin is an interesting issue because that is now in the ACLS guidelines for cardiac resuscitation along with epinephrine or instead of epinephrine for cardiac arrest. So every pulseless individual gets epi, right? But they can also get 40 units of vasopressin. Case reports have started to come out now about people in the field or in the ER who really had a cardiac shock or hypotension, but because of anaphylaxis and were given vasopressin, and most of the time it was effective. H1 and H2 antagonists are second line. Do not, please, do not treat anaphylaxis with just Benadryl and steroids. Steroids are good, though, but they're untested. They're almost universally given, but we don't really have hard data on their function. They probably have a delayed onset of action, and they may help prevent a recrudescence, like a secondary reaction. And finally, glucagon, especially in patients where there's concern about beta blockade and the effectiveness of epinephrine. But now we have vasopressin. A number of patients, and this varies in study to study, will require a second dose of epinephrine. It's hard to say who's going to have that, but it seems like the patients with more severe or refractory hypotension or hypoxemia are the ones that get a second dose of epinephrine. That can range anywhere from 16 to 36% in various studies. You have to just keep looking at the patient to figure that out. Okay, what labs can you obtain? Again, the history trumps all diagnostic tests, but there are some things you should try and get. Serum histamine is not easy. It has a rapid peak. By the time someone gets in, the histamine may already be waning and you may miss it. Second thing is serum tryptase. As I said before, get a total and a beta so that you can distinguish the immature and the mature, and you can differentiate between mast cell burden and mast cell activation. You have to do that probably within 1 to 6 hours of the initiation of the reaction. But in some patients, again, especially those from the 1996 report on the idiopathic anaphylaxis patients, it can hang around a bit longer. So you might as well get it. A negative tryptase is not high negative predictive value for anaphylaxis, especially if the anaphylaxis is suspected to be food-induced. This is an important point. You can get a so-called false negative for a number of reasons. Gut mast cells don't contain as much tryptase as some of the other mast cells. Tryptase may be dumped into the gut lumen, and you may lose it from the blood. And last but not least, if basophils do have a pathogenetic role, a pathobiologic role in anaphylaxis, they don't contain nearly as much tryptase as mast cells. So they may be important players in true vasoactive mediators, and maybe even cytokines, but they might not release enough tryptase for you to know that they're there. And last but not least, mast cell carboxypeptidase, not ready for prime time, but it's in the offing. Biphasic reactions can occur in anywhere from 3 to 20% of patients. If a patient presents with severe symptoms, your index of suspicion or concern that they might have a biphasic reaction should be heightened. It can happen anywhere from 1 to 72 hours. That's important, especially if the antigen persists in the body for long periods and the mast cells have a chance to so-called recover. That may happen with drugs or venoms. They can occur in the ED or out of the ED. You'd probably rather have it happen in the ED. So most guidelines suggest that if a patient has severe symptoms, that patient at least be monitored for 4 to 6 hours. And you tailor it to the severity of the symptoms. Humphrey looked at the experience in the UK at fatal anaphylaxis. And I don't have much time, so I'll just have to burn through this quickly. But let me just say that this was extremely concerning because among the patients who died of anaphylaxis, and he looked at 125 cases right here, almost 50% were iatrogenic. And that included the administration of radiocontrast materials, antibiotics, anesthetics. 37 of the 125 were food, and 32 were venom, and one was a hydatid cyst that ruptured. But once you've saved the patient, you shouldn't just leave them. You should refer them to someone, probably Dr. Castells, right? So someone who's going to manage their risk long-term. You've got to confirm the diagnosis. That's largely by history, but there are certain diagnostic tests that should be run, such as the skin tests, CAP to measure antigen-specific IgE, possibly double-blind placebo-controlled food challenge, and possibly basophil in vitro activation tests, which I mentioned earlier. Serum peptide microarrays are tantalizing, but not ready for prime time. What's that? That's where you've got a microarray looking at the different suspected proteins. If a patient's serum binds to different epitopes of the same protein, that suggests that they have multiple different IgEs, and it might be easier for that protein antigen to cross-link their mast cell IgE. You have to look at their comorbidities, especially asthma, and some of their medications, as I mentioned before, that can contribute not so much to the severity of a reaction, but to how you might treat it and how quickly you might move to a secondary treatment, such as glucagon. A verification of triggers. New triggers come up, especially as people appreciate cross-reactivity among antigens, and then to look at the mechanisms. So examples of comorbidities, as I mentioned, asthma, cardiovascular disease, lack of coordination. You know, the patient was severe, you know, even though she's only in her 50s, she's got severe rheumatoid arthritis. It's not easy necessarily for her to self-administer the epinephrine pen. So you've got to just take that into consideration when you figure out how you're going to treat her. And then a number of medications, again, that we give, while not necessarily causing anaphylaxis, may impede its effective treatment. But I'll come back to this issue about beta blockers in a moment. You've got to get people educated. You've got to have them avoid triggers. And that's really the critical thing. They've got to be conscious. You want them vigilant, not paranoid, where they totally twist their lives inside out, and not totally unconscious, where they don't care what they eat or they don't care what they wear when they go outside to garden. You can prevent it. If you know that it's exercise-induced food-associated, you can separate exercise from food ingestion, and you can prevent reactions. If they have idiopathic anaphylaxis, you can treat it medically with H1, H2 antagonists, steroids, leukotriene modifiers, and there are published weaning protocols to get people on the minimum dose of steroid necessary. But there's a broad range in that. There are some people with so-called idiopathic anaphylaxis who only need to be treated with prophylactic medications for 3 months, and there are some who get treated for 15 years. So that's highly controversial. Allergen desensitization can be done sometimes. Obviously, it can be done for a number of drugs, antibiotics, aspirin and nonsteroidals, semen, venom, and then most intriguing is the potential role for anti-IgE in the prophylaxis, so to speak, against anaphylaxis. Self-injectable epinephrine pen, and everyone, especially children, should have an action plan. And the general public should be kind of informed and educated about how to treat it. Should patients who have known coronary artery disease, like CHF, or who've just been post-MI, there are millions of these patients, right, every year, and they get put on beta blockers. What if they're allergic to peanut? So Tenbrook et al. Constructed a mathematical model looking at the risk of having or not having a beta blocker for both death and severe or life-threatening anaphylaxis. And essentially what they found is that unless the predicted likelihood of anaphylaxis is somewhere greater than 6% per year, beta blockers are indicated. You should give beta blockers, they concluded, to your patients who are at risk for anaphylaxis because those patients are more likely to die of cardiac disease and they are better protected from cardiac disease by their beta blocker than they are put at risk for non-function of epinephrine by the beta blocker. That is highly controversial. I only introduce it here not to tell you what to do, but to tell you that, again, you've got to tailor that decision to the patient's level of comfort, the patient's degree of disease. You've got to talk to the cardiologist, and you've got to make a plan as a group because no two patients are alike, obviously. No two doses of beta blocker are necessarily the same, and the entire circumstance of the patient has to be taken into account when you make a decision like this. This is a mathematical model. It is not proof in a randomized placebo-controlled trial. History is the most important piece of data. Patients should wear medical alert bracelets. Dr. Scheffer did a brilliant thing on one of the patients that I saw who came in with arguably an anaphylactic episode. I've got to tell you this story before we break. This woman came in. She was eating a salad. She had what sounded like an anaphylactic episode or near anaphylactic episode. She is a woman who is very refined. She goes to nice restaurants with her husband. They know what they're doing. I do not know what I'm doing in those restaurants. So Dr. Scheffer said, "Do you want me to speak to her?" I said, "Yes, please." And he tells her the greatest thing. He says, "When you go in, tell them," she had skin testing, it's proven that she was hypersensitive to avocado. He said, "Tell them that you cannot have avocado." He said, "But don't tell them that if you get it, you might die. Because in a fancy French restaurant, they don't care if you die. Tell them that you are going to become violently ill and vomit all over the place, and that you might even have terrible diarrhea in the restaurant that they care about." And she took that to the bank. I mean, she really played that like a Stradivarius, and it worked brilliantly. I mean, this woman has had no reaction since then, and she has in no way curtailed her salad consumption in fine French restaurants. Okay? I'm going to stop in just 1 second, but I want to tell you that because there's the potential for patients to need more than one dose of epinephrine, when you prescribe it, you've got to prescribe multiple versions of this. There are a number of ways to do this. You can give two packs of epinephrine pens, EpiPens. You can give the twin check. Some people prefer one, some people prefer the other. I give them out four at a time. You've got to have one on your person at all time. You've got to have one at home. You've got to have one at work. You probably have to have one in the car. It's not good to have one in the car because it gets too hot in the car or it gets too cold in the car. But there are a number of case reports that document that expired epinephrine is better than no epinephrine. And there have been a bunch of people saved by expired epinephrine. So give plenty of this. How do you train a patient in using the epinephrine pen? This is maybe the only useful thing I will tell you today. Here we go. This is a trainer pen. So you hold this up and you say to the patient, "This is a trainer pen. There's no needle in here. There's no medicine. But we're going to use it to practice. If you think maybe you're having a severe episode, a severe allergic attack, anaphylaxis, and you think, should I use it? Use it. It comes in a box. In a tube, the tube protects it from light, because light will make epinephrine break down. It's good for about 90 days, probably about a year, but you don't tell them that. Epinephrine, you tell the patient, is a completely natural hormone. Your own body makes it. It's not really a medicine. It's a life-saving hormone that you just need an extra dose of to take away a severe allergic attack, and this will do it. What's inside is a dose of the medicine, a little spring, and a little needle. You do not say a large javelin. You say a little needle. This is a lie, but it gets people to use this until we get sublingual epinephrine. So, if you think you need it, you take it out of the container. You hold it up like this with the point up. You do not touch the point because there are case reports of people who've activated it and stung themselves in the finger, and then their finger gets vasoconstricted and you can lose a digit that way. So, you hold it up like this. It's locked. So you unlock it by pulling off the cap on the bottom. Now you're ready to use it. And you take your anterolateral thigh and you hold it against. You do not stab yourself with it. You hold it against the side and you press until you hear it and feel it click like this. And when you do, the needle will come out and it will scratch your skin. Do not say it will puncture your skin. Do not say it will travel deep into your tissues. Just say it will scratch your skin and it will inject the medicine. But if you pull the needle out as soon as you feel it, the medicine will spray all over. So you've got to hold it there till you count to 10. Then you recap this, you give it to the patient, and you say, now you show me how to do it. And they do it, and they're trained. Okay, that's how to train a patient. I'm going to stop here. I know I've gone over time. Thank you very much. I would just like to say in parting that it's been a real pleasure. If you have any questions, I'll try and answer them. And hi, Mom, I'm finally on TV.
David, thank you very much. I know the